Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined on this beautiful day of cloudiness in Cape Town by Makone Maja, who is in Joburg. Makone, how are you? Or Pretoria. Actually, where are you, Makone?
Wishing I was in Cape Town, but Joburg is correct.
And experiencing some connectivity problems today, which is why probably her camera will be off much of it. We are joined today by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, how are you?
Hello, Nicholas. I'm doing well, thank you. Sorry, my camera, when I started it, now it already started to give some issues, so I'll just keep it off.
We shall have to simply enjoy the melodious tones rather than seeing you, but I'm sure our listeners will forgive us, considering we originally were an audio-only podcast. But anyway, let's get into the news of today. And the first thing we're going to talk about is crime stats. And as we all know, South Africa is one of the most violent countries on earth that is not actually at war. An average of 75 people are killed in South Africa every single day, which is an absolutely crazy number. So we've just gotten our statistics for the third quarter of 2024-2025 financial year, which the police have released. And good news, they do show that from the previous third quarter, murder is down by about 10%. So things are moving in the right direction, but they remain shockingly high. There was a 9.8% decrease in murder cases. Between October and December of 2024, there were 6,953 murders compared to 7,710 murders in the same period in 2023. There was a 3.3% reduction in rape cases. Of the murders, and this is one of those very interesting statistics to look at, police said 1,453 were because of arguments between people. So that's presumably often drunk people or emotionally distressed people getting into fights, like unplanned arguments and that resulting in murder. 405 were robbery related. 389 were vigilante attacks, which is actually a shocking number that I think we should dive into a bit more in our discussion here. 294 were gang-related murders, and 57 were taxi-related murders. So I think that gives us an idea of the scale of violence in the taxi industry if they have their own category in police reporting. More than half of the murders occurred in public places, and firearms and knives were the most commonly used weapons. Police recorded 12 farm murders. 5 of the victims were farm dwellers, 4 were employees, and 1 was a farmer. Police also recorded 8 murders at primary and secondary schools and 3 at tertiary institutions. Police say that there has been a decrease in cases opened for sexual offenses, robbery with aggravating circumstances, attempted murder, carjacking, and robbery of residential and business premises. The vast majority of the crimes occurred in 4 provinces: Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern and Western Cape. Now, that's not entirely surprising because those are basically the most populous provinces in the country. But the national murders, about 25% were carried out in Gauteng, 21% in KZN, 18% in the Eastern Cape, and 17% in the Western Cape. The Western Cape was, as it usually is, the center of gang violence, with 263 gang murders in this quarter alone. 135 of those occurred in Bishop, Lavis, Mitchell's Plain, Plainflay, Delft, Elf, East River, all around Cape Town. Makone, let me start with you. We seem to be moving in the right direction. Is this due to Senzo Machuno's influence? I do think that Bheki Cele was uniquely incompetent as police minister, and so I think Machuno definitely seems to be better as a police minister. I just can't stop thinking about that incredibly high number of vigilante attacks, outnumbering the number of gang-related murders. I mean, I wonder how many other countries in the world there are more vigilante attacks than gang murders. What's your take on these statistics?
The improvements are welcome, Nick. This is, I believe, the second quarter where we're seeing a decrease in some of those crime statistics that remain shockingly high. I was saying to you guys before the show, it's a dangerous place in South Africa to have an argument just because of how high arguments rank on the list of causal factors that ultimately lead to murder. Yeah, people are quite hot-headed in South Africa. The police have their hands full. And when you look at those vigilante murders, I think it shows that people are usurping the role of the police in enforcing justice. Vigilante justice is instant, and yeah, it certainly works faster than the courts, although it should be discouraged. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong other than the fact that it's a crime for you to you know, take that action of bringing about justice into your own hands. But this is welcome. Anyone other than our former Minister of Police would have, I think, resulted in an improvement. But I think what's going to effectively continue this decline is better coordination of our police and intelligence on reining in crime. You're seeing this with somebody like General Mkhwanazi in KwaZulu-Natal, how his presence there has given people in KZN and I think the country at large a lot of confidence back into our police. You just see how people back him because they're able to see their lives being improved so much by, you know, him facing and not being shy to really confront some of the gangs in KwaZulu-Natal. So I think the more police presence we see should result in crime stats going down. There were more police who were released in KZN during the elections because the government was wary that there would be political violence ensuing there during the elections. Luckily, there was none, but that also contributed to crime stats going down. As you saw, those four most violent provinces include KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, Western and Eastern Cape. So it's very encouraging to see that crime statistics are going down and hopefully that trend continues.
So unfortunately, the South African Police Service remains probably the most untrusted institution in the country. I can't remember the exact figures, but surveys done where they ask South Africans, you know, what do you think of this institution? SAPS almost always is towards the bottom of that list, unfortunately. And that creates the question, well, are these crime statistics accurate? Because there is, you know, a tendency for people not to report. I mean, the last time I had a break-in, I was in a physical fight with the person who broke in, and then they fled. And no case ended up being opened because when I hit the guy over the head with the kettle, he dropped the thing he was stealing from my house. So that didn't end up in police statistics. So you'd think, okay, well, what are the, you know, what is the true figure? How many are just ignored because people don't bother with the police? And that's why criminologists, when they look at sort of comparative crime stats across countries, you usually look at murder in particular. Murder is by far the hardest to just ignore or to cover up. And so the murder statistics may not be 100% accurate, but they're the closest to accurate you get. So they're a really good barometer for the overall state of crime in the country, whereas, you know, it's difficult to tell some of the others. But yeah, I think the vigilante attacks really speak to that stat about how untrusted the SAPs are. I guess the question is, Anlu, like, how do we actually start to begin moving forward away from this? This is, I think, one of the great crises of South Africa. We have seen changes in our crime rate over the years. In about 2010, I think our crime rate reached the lowest it had been in a very long time, with relatively, you know, I think murders were sort of half what they were per day now. And since then, they've climbed back up. They're not quite at the same levels that we had in the 90s, thank goodness. But it really seems as though the police need significant reform and overhaul and perhaps restructuring entirely. Maybe we should be thinking of the police in a completely different way, breaking them up into provincial units rather than having one big nationalized force, improving training, allowing citizens to have more input on police. What are your thoughts on this story, Anlu?
Nicholas, I think you made an excellent point that the murder rate is perhaps one of the most reliable statistics that we have in this regard. Excuse me. And so one of the stats that stood out to me was specifically the one that half of all murders occur in a public place, which to me indicates that South Africa doesn't have a crime problem. We have a blatant crime problem in the sense that people are not scared of the police at all. they're more likely to actually get away with it than to be caught. So I think that's a good start. The start would be to make sure, firstly, of course, we need police presence. We need an increased police presence, and we can to some extent see that where there is an increase in police presence, we see a little bit of a decrease in crime stats. But there's also the problem of accountability. I recall, I think it was something insane, like 2,000 guns that were sold to gang members back in 2007, probably between that and say 2015. And it was done by an ex-police officer. I think Christian Prinsloo or something like that. It was some, yeah. And of the 2,000 guns that he sold to gang members, 1,000 of them was already found to be involved in murders. And I mean that's the start. We need to actually introduce a sense of accountability back into the civil service as a whole. Because I think the same issues we see in the police service, we also see to some extent in other areas of the civil service play out. And the major issue that this points back to me is that the moment we stop hiring the best person for the job, we start seeing it play out in lower accountability. We start seeing a lower quality of service actually being delivered by civil servants. So I'd suggest, yeah, I think you have a good suggestion in the sense of better training, better equipment, but that all sounds to me like an extra budget item, which at the moment we really can't afford. And I think it is incredibly important, but I think that doesn't solve the root issue, which is not hiring the correct person for the job. And I think that would be a good start to actually, instead of having policies that promote certain criteria of people, just hire the best person for the job. I think that's the best start for now.
I do take I do want to push back a little bit on the budget point, which is that for me, the core function of the state is safety and security. So in other words, we should be spending less money on other things, and more money on police, which is, and I think that could be done, without too much pain if you reduced waste, as we shall go into in our third story. We'll get there in a second. Just on your point about the number of police firearms lost by police, I think in the third quarter of or the second quarter of last year, there were 300 firearms lost by police. I'm not sure if that's a quarterly or annual figure, but a very significant number of firearms is either lost or stolen from police officers every single year. And this is often kind of almost waved away as, ah, well, what are you going to do? I mean, it's a really serious problem. Makone, final thoughts on this issue?
I think there is an experiences that South Africans have with the police, like yours, Nick, that demonstrate why people just simply don't trust the police. I had a similar encounter once where I had a theft out of a motor vehicle and tried to report it to the police, and then they played the game of jurisdiction with me. So they were saying, well, from this street on, you can report to us, but from that street forwards, it's a different police jurisdiction, which is absolutely not true. They were just making things up. And this is a police station that is.
They wanted to do that because their stats, they didn't want their stats to get worse, because then they get in trouble.
That explains it. There was
Yeah,
nobody in there. It was just me reporting the crime.
I've been to CPF meetings where the police obsess over these stats, and theft out of motor vehicles is very often a pretty high one, particularly in suburban areas. So they obsess with getting it down, which is exactly why they tried to lob it onto another police station so that they wouldn't have to include it.
That makes sense because it happened at a garage. The garage themselves refused to release footage as well because then that stuff starts circulating online and brings obviously it creates a bad reputation problem for the garage. But yeah, that game, and I've seen so many accounts on social media of people saying the exact same thing, that the police are sending them the runaround over a crime that happened in their area. So it explains it. That's one incident. I'm sure there's far worse things that happen in remote communities and even in townships of like police just not doing their work, or even perpetuating some of the crime, aiding and abetting in some of the crime. But yeah, I think police visibility for me has been one of the most effective ways of controlling, helping to control people's impulses, right? You're not just going to pull out a gun and shoot someone if you know that the police tends to do the rounds in that area. So I agree with you, Nick. They have to make a plan. Where there are budgetary cuts, I don't think they should be there for the police. If anything, as there's been population increases in South Africa, the police should correspondingly increase so that there's more of them as there are more South Africans in our country.
Yeah, that particular break-in I had, one of the reasons it didn't end in a worse way for me was that we had private security guards nearby, and the police did actually show up. They weren't particularly interested in opening a case of any kind. I waited with the private security guard for an hour and a half, I think, for them to arrive, which is not an untypical amount of time to wait for the cops sometimes, which was spent chatting with the private security guard about all of his colleagues who had been killed in the line of duty over the last couple of years, which was quite harrowing stuff. Anyway, when they did arrive, they sort of wandered around. I showed them what had happened. I told them what had happened. I gave them a piece of evidence I got from the scene, and they went, eh. And then they left, and I never heard anything more. But yeah, no, that's not an unusual story for many South Africans, unfortunately.
I conducted my own investigation as well. I put on my Jacques Lizot hat, and I drove everywhere trying to collect as much evidence as I can so that I can strengthen my case to help the police. And yeah, they were just not keen at all. So unfortunately,
someone I know,
there are many cases.
Someone I know tried to open an assault case with the police, and he had a video of the incident, and the police couldn't get it because their email address at the police station didn't work. The investigating officer didn't have airtime or something to be able to download the video off of WhatsApp. Wow. So the person in the end took it to the police station on a flash drive. Like, just fix those things in the police, and then like we can start talking about the bigger structural stuff. But just that's some really basic stuff to get right.
Indeed.
Anyway, okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is actually really, really good news, I think. It looks like the finance ministry in South Africa is telling the health ministry, the health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, to go jump rather than fund the NHI. Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana says that until a price tag has been attached to the national health insurance, he cannot budget for it. He says that he's adopting a sort of wait and see approach on NHI, saying that all estimated costs to date have been based on guesswork. Minister Motsoaledi must submit a document to government saying how he is going to roll out the implementation of the NHI so all of us can engage with it and understand the full cost of implementation over what period. Godongwana also said that several health facilities do not meet the threshold of what's required for universal healthcare, and there needs to be the construction of more high-quality hospitals before the process of implementing NHI can start. He said the infrastructure has to be upgraded substantially for hospitals to be able to be compliant with the NHI. That's where we are in terms of the costs. And this seems like really good news, Anlu, because it looks like the finance ministry is putting its foot down. And, you know, you can try and implement NHI, but good luck when you have absolutely no budget for it. And I think this is a concession to reality that as much as Motsoaledi may want to push through NHI, it's not likely to happen, at least for the next year or two, unless he somehow manages to get the ANC to give him the money. What do you make it, Sonia?
Yeah, Nicholas, I'm very happy to see a little bit of the rubber in his arm solidifying, if that's the way. I don't know what's the next phase of rubber. Hopefully there is a more solid phase. But yeah, so I went back and had a look at a little bit of kind of trying to establish what the sentiment change was around NHI, because I wasn't entirely sure whether up until now what was Godongwana's statement on NHI exactly. And it was actually very interesting because, so back March last year, just after, I think, if I'm correct, that's just after the act was signed. He was essentially saying that they will be funding for it. At this stage, there's no saying whether the funding is going to come from taxes. And I remember him specifically saying that, so there's a few options for them, and it is obviously at his disposal to use tax increases if it is needed. So whatever needs to happen, he'll make sure that it is funded. And he specifically, actually very interesting, caught my attention, said, if he does talk about taxes again, he'll do so on the, he said, on the 19th of February next year. It obviously didn't happen, but it was very interesting that he mentioned back then that they, if he talks about tax increases, it would be then. And then we saw in December of last year, him saying that is the exact funding and the ways, the mechanisms for funding NHI is not yet an issue for him. There is a little bit of funding going to the health department, but he specifically said that he's not too worried about where the funding is going to come from. And then we see this very clear sentiment shift that we see now, which I think indicates one thing, and that's that he's under pressure. We obviously know that by the fact that he had to postpone the budget, but it also shows that there's a very tight, like tough trade-offs that he needs to make. And then, yeah, just specifically on him actually requesting a document for what is actually, what's the rollout plan, what does implementation look like, and also some kind of cost estimate. It's a little bit worrying because I'm not exactly sure when he's expecting this. If it is within 3 weeks, that's a near impossible task. I mean, I'm sure that there's, as difficult as it is up until now, estimates has just been guesswork. So it's a little bit difficult even for the health department themselves to put an estimate to it. So I'm very happy to see it. And I'm happy to see the shift in sentiment. I think we've for long been saying that the budget will be the judge for political driven agendas. The budget will be the judge, and I'm happy to see that happen.
Makone, I think probably the DA can also maybe take some credit for the pressure here, because they've been staunchly opposed to NHI, and apparently they did reach some sort of agreement with Ramaphosa that was not very specifically reported on. The details were a little bit lacking a couple of weeks ago, where basically Ramaphosa seems to have promised them that NHI would remain on the books, but then just wouldn't be implemented because there'd be no funding given to it. And I think the only part of NHI that Ramaphosa mentioned during SONA was the establishment of a single healthcare records keeping service and nothing else. Am I right in saying that this is another former opposition victory?
I agree. I think the president has also been very pragmatic about the NHI. I remember early last year, I think it was shortly after the act had been signed, Minister Motsoaledi was still determined to implement the NHI as it is. And he was jamming it down afterwards. And the president came out and said, well, you can't do that. And you have to consider all the different proposals for how to actually implement the NHI. Because at the time, there were different health groups and organizations proposing alternate means of bringing about nationalized healthcare without eradicating medical aids altogether. So I do think the president on this has also been very tempered, not as radical as some of the staunchly pro NHI proponents in the cabinet. But I also think Godongwana is absolutely right that, you know, Minister Motsoaledi should not just expect that he's going to dream up the biggest social welfare program in South Africa's history, and he never actually has to account for how he aims to implement it and wants to burden Treasury with that responsibility, right? And in the article, Mr. Godongwana says this is just it's just guesswork. So far, all the calculations about how to implement the NHI have just been guesswork, which is absolutely insane. And I was also reading an article a few days earlier from Business Tech where they discussed that back in 2015, when Minister Motsoaledi was still Minister of Health, there were proposals for low-cost benefit options, which he declined. And he argued that there was not enough evidence to demonstrate how the populations that would be that these low cost benefit options would be proposed for would actually interact with medical aids, those low cost benefit option medical aids. And yet he himself does not have evidence for where the money to fund the NHI is going to emerge, and that we have a parliament that would vote for the biggest, likely the biggest expenditure item on our budget without actually asking questions about where the money will come from to implement and execute it. So I'm quite shocked that we could just dream up scenarios as ministers without ever having to come up with a plan for how we aim to implement it, and that you'll just squeeze South Africans to the death to ensure that your single tunnel vision is brought about.
Yeah, and while he was dodging, you know, firm costing of this stuff, he was also trying to slip into the medium term development thing, development budget proposals that private medical aid be abolished within 5 years. I mean, within 4 years. Sorry, I mean, it's complete madness. Okay, let's move on, I think, to our last story of today. And this is from a relatively new site, currencynews.co.za. It's got some good people working for it based off of my quick squiz of the byline. But they had this great write-up titled How Joburg Sets Fire to Your Money. And basically, it just goes through a lot of findings from the Auditor General's report on why exactly Joburg is in the financial trouble that it's in right now. And it's absolutely fascinating. This total city budget is something around 80 billion rand per year. However, around 12 billion rand of that was irregular and unauthorized expenditure, which is absolutely insane amount. That's like over 10%. This report sort of details some of the things that the city was spending money on, a huge amount of money in a legal claim from a woman who fell into an orchestra pit, a huge legal claim for someone who was in a lift that crashed to the bottom floor, people in Sachsenwald suing the Joburg Roads Agency for not fixing up the roads in their area. Huge losses in electricity with around 5 billion rand spent on that. Massive losses in water with around 3 billion rand and 2.1 billion rand lost to leaks. The city is actually marking up the price of electricity and water by around 10% and yet still doesn't have enough money to pay for the infrastructure. Irregular expenditure by itself, not including the unauthorized expenditure, was around 3.5 billion. Irregular contracts, deviations from supply chain management processes, non-compliance with the Municipal Financial Management Act, bidders who didn't meet tender specifications, emergency procurement, which is the great way of always slipping in corruption. It details the case of one municipal official who apparently didn't do the correct thing on a fire truck purchasing agreement, and despite this causing the city to waste tens of millions of rands, he received a final written warning valid for 12 months, forfeiting 10 days salary and not being able to be promoted for a year, which is, I think, kind of lays bare the problem, is that there's absolutely no accountability in local government, at least in Joburg, it seems. So this, I think, is a great picture, Makone, of why we actually shouldn't be jacking up rates and jacking up prices and jacking up, every burden on the citizens of our municipalities. We should be focusing on getting rid of the absolutely enormous waste. You'll never get rid of all of it, but you can do better than 12 billion rand, I can tell you that much.
Absolutely. I believe it was Anlu whose press release went out this week listing the IRR's reforms for the budget. And on them were included on them were the Zondo dividend, which is effectively the IRR's way of saying that the Zondo recommendations need to be implemented. That is one way you can cut back on wastage of fruitless and wasteful expenditure that is just enormous in our local governments. Also cutting back on BEE tax, like you mildly put it there, that unaccounted for tender is probably just a way of doling out patronage. And you can cut back on that through the BEE tax because you remove all the incentives for corruption if we are tendering based on value for money procurement rather than what we've been doing over the last 20 years. So I think that those reforms, and we're not just the only ones calling for reforms that would see wastage being cut back. In fact, it's also a strong case to be made that tax should not be increased, but rather that it should be decreased because the government is not able to control all that revenue it generates. Even though there's a 10% markup on water, 10% markup on electricity, that's supposed to go towards the maintenance of infrastructure, that's simply not happening. You can see with the water crisis that is upon us here in Joburg, and with somebody also put in the chat that they've had electricity cuts or outages in the eastern parts of Pretoria, just because municipalities are not able to control even the little revenue that they generate. So it's definitely a great argument to be made for tax cuts and for the Zondo dividend.
Anlu, final thoughts?
If I can unmute myself, yes. Nicholas, I think Makone's, I agree with you 100% that municipalities can't even manage the little revenue that they do collect, and it creates a negative feedback loop almost, where for municipalities that also mean that they now need to hike up their rates. That means that people actually just can't afford the rate increases. There's more debt outstanding, whether it's an individual owing to the municipality. And then it also fits into the bigger picture where municipalities at the end of the day end up with a 109 billion rand debt to Eskom. So just a quick mention on tax rates is the thing that many other economies and governments have a lot higher tax rates. But it's exactly the problem that we don't actually see anything come back to the public. There's absolutely horrible service delivery. So people are much more likely to be willing to pay higher taxes if they actually know that it will come back to them in the form of quality service delivery. And then there's one very funny thing that you, obviously there's a lot to talk about, but that stood out to me is that there's an instance where they invested money into a bank that was not even qualified as a bank under the Banking Act, which is, it points to a common sense problem and a common sense problem in the wider, again, civil service. And I usually say that the moment, Makone, I've also heard you say it, that the moment we can actually start quantifying the problem, we can start doing something about it. If we can't get the annual reports to actually indicate there's a backlog from 2010, on investigations into irregular and fruitless spending, which you, if you can't quantify that problem, you can't actually start to do something about it. Miserable situation, but hopefully I want to put an ad note, but I don't know what to say.
Well, we are out of time, I think, for today. But thank you very much, everyone, for watching. Thank you to Anlu and Makone for being on the show today. And I hope everyone has a wonderful and fantastic weekend. We shall see you all next week on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great one.